ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
First, I offer my respectful obeisances to my spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder acharya of this International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He came to America with the specific idea of inculcating the traditional movement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Western world. It was an idea given to him by his spiritual master, His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who had been wildly successful in India in spreading the movement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And when A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, at that time just a young man in his 20s, had met his future spiritual master for the first time, his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, had requested him rather abruptly that you should help spread this all over the world. And there's good reason for that. It is a movement based on the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, in which the commonality of all living entities is recognized. In fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmane Gavi Hastini Shuni Chaiva Shrupakecha Pandita Samadarshina, that the hallmark of a learned person, a pundit, is that he or she sees the commonality of all living beings. In this specific verse, it's said that such a person would see a brahmana, a highly learned priest, an elephant, a cow, a dog, and what they call a dog eater, someone coming from a culture where eating dogs is the norm, with an equal vision. How is it equal vision? Seeing that each one is actually a spiritual being inhabiting a particular body, and that particular body has been attained by that spiritual being by interacting with the material world. And this is considered transcendental vision. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about how various people view the world according to how they're affected by what he describes as the three modalities. One is called tamas, or ignorance, which provides no light at all. And in tamas, or what is also called darkness, one is in a suffering condition of life and doesn't know how to get out of it. In passion, which is the next mode higher, or rajas, one is impelled to act and works hard for getting some result. And above that is the higher mode of goodness, sattva. And from sattva, sattvam yad brahmadarshanam, means that one can actually see the truth. One can see that there is a difference between matter and spirit. And from that kind of vision, one can do activities in life that are beneficial, that lead one to a good result. So, Srila Prabhupada came with the idea of propagating knowledge that would give people an opportunity to improve their lives. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, his spiritual master, consistently taught that there are many different good works that one can do in the world to help others. But he consistently showed how the best way to help others is by giving them clear knowledge. First of all, the Vedas say that every human being has a capacity to understand spiritual knowledge. From whatever situation they're in, one has the wherewithal to take what's given in the scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam and apply it systematically and therefore improve his or her life. This is one of the basic premises on which Srila Prabhupada began this movement. It's stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam by Shukadev Goswami, who's speaking the Bhagavatam. Kirata hunandra pulinda pukasha apira shumba yavanaka sadaya yene cha papa yada pashraya shraya shudyanti tasmai pravavishnave namaha. He lists varieties of people who live what are considered by the Vedic standards to be wildly unregulated lives, outside any kind of focus on spiritual advancement. And then he says that it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter how you start, what you're born into, because if you're diligent in applying the principles that come from the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and you take help from those who are already spiritually advanced, then you can rise to the occasion. You can rise above the lower modes of material nature. And Krishna says as much in the Bhagavad Gita, mamcha yo vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. That is, if one consistently performs devotional service, bhakti, and that's what we're teaching here, then one rises above the limitations that one is born into. Everyone has some limitation that one's born into, because the material world is a very complex place. And the consideration of the Vedic scriptures is that each soul has had many, many encounters in the material world, many lifetimes, and has had plenty of time to entangle him or herself in the laws of karma. But through these two activities, knowledge and practice, by getting correct knowledge and information, which is what the Vedic scriptures called Shruti Praman, or evidence that comes from beyond the purview of the three modes of material nature, and by applying that in a regulated way, then anyone from any situation can improve and come to a higher situation in life. I feel better now. Thank you. I was waiting all week for that. It's the only place you get this in Silicon Valley. A flower garland. It just seems that in modern society, I mean, if you go to the flower market in San Francisco, you find that there are a lot of people there buying flowers. It such seems like a civilized thing to do. I had that service for a while. I drive down early in the morning to the flower market. It's when you have to go. All the serious buyers go down at around 4 a.m. That's when it opens up. And you go down there and you can pick out all your flowers. All the florists are there. The big buyers are buying flowers. And it's considered to be one of the nicer places in San Francisco, because flowers are a natural expression of beauty. And Prabhupada, in his writings, mentions that human beings require some aesthetic stimulation. Libraries, parks, and scenes of beauty, fresh water, these kinds of things are necessary to cultivate the human spirit enough so that we have the balance to practice spiritual life. And oftentimes when I wear one of these garlands, leave a temple and I go through an airport like LAX, people always stop and take a look. Say, where'd you get that? How'd you get flowers around your neck? And I usually offer them the the garland, and it's a big surprise for them. But Krishna consciousness is a big surprise. There are a lot of very surprising aspects. There's a kind of conditioning that the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita talks about that one can fall into, thinking that this material world is the all in all. And this is something that I came in, an idea I came in contact with when I first read literature about Krishna consciousness. The first piece of literature I got was called Bhakti Godhead magazine. Has anybody heard of it? Bhakti Godhead? This was the flagship magazine that was started by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Now, of course, we have many of his books. He started, however, writing articles for a magazine that he himself started called Back to Godhead when he was in India, before he came to America. And in that, he would pick topical things to write about and relate them to Krishna consciousness. And he would write the articles, he would publish the magazine himself, and then he'd go out and sell it himself. He spent years going around procuring paper, even at a time when it was very difficult to buy paper in India. And he was the marketing manager, the accountant, the CEO, the publishing director. And that was his foray into writing and distributing literature. So when he came to America, he had to suspend that for a little while because he was traveling, and a long way also. But he picked it right back up again, and there's a description of the Back to Godhead magazine being revived in America, in New York City, that's in the book called the Leelamrita, Srila Prabhupada Leelamrita. It's a story of the life of Srila Prabhupada, and in there describes how he had passed on the duties of producing this magazine to his disciples, to write articles, to publish the magazine, and so forth. So there's a very charming recount of the restart of Back to Guided magazine that's in this book, Prabhupada Leelamrita. It's a very large book, and it's one that when you start reading, you won't be able to put down, and you'll be sorry when it's over. So I recommend that also. In the retelling of that story, the devotees at that time had not much resource to print a magazine, so they got paper from wherever they could, and they used, at that time, a mimeograph machine, which was the modern equivalent of the printer. You all have a printer at home, an HP or an Epson, right? Well, those didn't exist back in the old days. And one had to put in a sheet and then crank the machine, and then it would come out and it would make a print of the original. And it was done with some ink that had to dry off a little bit. So the devotees had bought one of those machines, and they collected the articles, they lined them up on paper, and then they put out the magazine, and then they just stapled it together. That was the first magazine in America. And Prabhupada came down to watch the assembly of this. There had been some benches donated to the makeshift temple that they had, and the devotees were lining up all the pages to collate them. There were no collating machines back then either. All this was done manually. And then the devotees at that time, these original pioneer devotees, would take out these printed magazines and they would sell them for 25 cents. And then they would bring whatever small profit there was back and then reinvest it into printing more. And as they did so, the magazine became more and more sophisticated. They were able to find better printers. They tightened up the way they were organizing the publication. And by the time 1973 rolled around, there was a color cover, and there were many illustrations inside. Devotees came forward who could illustrate and so forth. And some good writers had come. One particular writer was called Hayagriva. He had been an English professor at Ohio State University, and he joined Srila Prabhupada early on, became one of the first editors of Prabhupada's books, because Prabhupada asked various devotees to edit his books for force and clarity, correct any mistakes. And then he asked them all to write. So Hayagriva had written an article for this 1973 magazine. It was called Liberation of the Cave Dwellers. And it was a essay about what Socrates had said about the process of spiritual realization, in which he says, imagine some people who had been condemned to live in caves, and they were facing the back wall of the caves, and all the forms they knew of were what they saw on the walls of the caves that appeared as shadows from the outside world. They're unaware of direct sunlight or even what it looked like. Their eyes were in tune to the darkness. And one day, one of those cave dwellers somehow escaped and got out into the bright world and saw how people were living, how there was this phenomenon called the sun, which was illuminating everything. And after some time outside, came back to the various cave dwellers to tell them about this world of light outside. And Socrates had said that actually these cave dwellers were not open to hearing about another world. They said, what are you talking about? There is no other world. This is it. There's only these shadows. This is reality. And they couldn't believe in anything so fantastical as a sun. And after all, he says, how would one even describe the sun, what it looks like, or what its power is, to someone who had never seen the sun, had no conception of what it is? He said that person from the outside would have to bring in one ray of light and show them. It's something like this. This is one sample of what it's like. And when I was reading that magazine, and it was Hayagriva, the author, was pointing out how this material world, according to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, is like a cave. In fact, he describes how the material world is a dark place, but beyond this dark material world, he says, parastasmatu bhavo nyo vyakto vyaktat sanatanaha yaksak sarveshu bhuteshu nasyatsu navinasyati. He said there's a world that is illuminated. Every aspect of it is illuminated. It doesn't even need a sun or a moon. And it's never destroyed. The material world is named variously, but one of the names is Martyaloka, as a place where everyone's dying all the time. And that's one of the ways in which the cave dwellers assert themselves. They say, well, that's just natural. Everyone dies. Why try to go beyond that? This is just our reality. There is no such thing as deathlessness and so forth. But Krishna says otherwise. Beyond this dark material world, there's the bright, eternal spiritual world. The material world, he again says in the Bhagavad Gita, is constantly in flux. It's being annihilated and then recreated again and again. But he says the nature of the spiritual world is that it's never annihilated. There are various kinds of annihilation that take place in the material world. There's partial annihilation that takes place at the end of every day of Brahma, Brahma being the creator of the sub-creator of the material world. And that means parts of the universe become destroyed, and he has to recreate them every day, every one of his days, which is billions of years in earth years. And then there's a total annihilation at the end of the cycle in which the material world runs on, which in during which everything in the whole material cosmos is annihilated and wound back up in, again into the body of Mahavishnu. These are sort of some technical things I'm saying right now, but these are all described in great detail in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic scriptures. But one of the kinds of annihilation that is described is called constant annihilation. And this sometimes in physics is described as entropy, that everything that we hold on to sort of sifts through our fingers, it falls apart. Even when it was just raining for so long, you could see the houses start falling apart, everything starts melting. It's a melting world we're living in. And this is a little disconcerting for the soul, who is a permanent entity. It's counterintuitive. It's not something that we're used to. It's something that we are constantly trying to adjust to. That is that things are constantly being annihilated and falling apart. So, when I read that magazine and saw the article, I felt, yes, this room I'm sitting in right now is a cave. And this magazine that's come to me, a friend of mine brought it to me so I could read it. And I said, this is the light coming in. And in the Gita, Krishna talks about how transcendental knowledge is light. And he says that when one reads that transcendental knowledge and then even makes a small attempt to follow what it says, then Krishna, who is within the heart, also provides illumination. He says in the 10th chapter of the Gita, Teshan Ivanukam Partam Ahama Gyanajam Damaha Nashayam Yat Mabhavasto Gyana Dipena Bhashvata. Such a charming analogy that Krishna gives, that for those who are serious about spiritual life, I appear in their hearts and I light up that cave of their hearts with the lamp of knowledge so that they can see their way out of the darkness. And this is something that Krishna says throughout the Bhagavad Gita in very encouraging ways, that even if you take to this process a little bit, that it's never lost. The progress you make is never lost. And that if you simply inquire and you're sincerely trying, then Krishna will help you from within to show you how to do this. In fact, he says he'll give you intelligence how to make progress in spiritual life. So the natural proclivity of human beings is to inquire, to ask questions. How can I make my life better? But the Vedas say, ask the biggest question now that you have the opportunity. Don't settle for just asking how to solve economic problems, because that's something that comes naturally even to animals. You can observe in the wintertime how animals get a free coat without going shopping at Macy's or Nordstrom's or anywhere else. There's a cat who lives in my backyard. And every winter, she comes to show me her new coat. She says, look at this. And I said, where'd you get the coat? And she said, I don't know. It just comes to me. And the squirrels, too, they get a free coat. And everywhere you look around the universe, you'll see that there's a natural order in which living entities are being provided for. For instance, there are ants all over Mountain View. In fact, there are probably more ants under this property, under the foundation here, than there are people in Mountain View, or in San Mateo or Santa Clara County for that matter. But every one of them is having a little snack tonight. Every one of them gets to eat. And they all get intelligence how to build houses. Some of these nature channels show how the ants build these very sophisticated freeway systems. Have you seen? These scientists, they open up the ground and they find their freeways There's one way this way. You can only go drive this way, right hand side only. They're very intelligent. They know. And they can communicate also. They touch, they bump into, if you watch the ants, they bump into one another, and then they can sense where the food is. And then they'll find out where it is. They'll go get it, and they'll bring it back. And they're being taken care of. And the Vedas say, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Ekubahunam Yovidatati Kaman. There is one supreme eternal, and there is a plurality of dependent eternals. This is how the Vedas actually define our situation. It's very helpful to know this, that there is one supreme eternal, and what is he doing? He's fulfilling the desires of all the individual small eternal entities. He is independent. He doesn't require anyone else's help. But the living entities are sustained, and they do need help. And if one simply observes in nature how this is going on and sees that, or reasons correctly, because it's also stated very clearly in the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, that why do I need to work so hard to maintain myself if all these other living entities are getting free stuff without having to pay such a high price? Free goods. Fruit is out there on the trees. There's in my backyard, it's actually not in my backyard, it's in my neighbor's backyard, but there's a persimmon tree. And before all the persimmons come to complete fruition, the squirrels and the crows take them all away. And they know right where to go. They know which tree to go to. And then in the summertime when the plums come, they feast on that. And I sometimes see them hanging out on the back fence, these squirrels. They're so full that they can't move. They're hanging over the fence with a little tongue hanging out. I said, where'd you get all the food? It's like, it's just free. It's up in the tree. And Narada Muni says, therefore, if you notice that living entities are coming into whatever they deserve naturally, and he says that you just as you attain misery, not attain misery, just as misery visits you, even though you don't want it, so similarly, material happiness will come to you as well, even without you searching for it. Even if you don't look for it, the good things, the good fortune you're looking for will come to your life even without you seeking it. On the other side, even if you seek good fortune, you may not find it. That doesn't necessarily mean, because if you work harder or you put yourself in certain situations, that you're going to get more good fortune. There's a ledger already arranged, already accounted for, Narada Muni says, and you'll get a certain amount of good things in the material world and a certain amount of bad things according to what you deserve, what you've done before. And that's not something that you can rearrange. It comes by its own accord. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after taking sannyas, went out into the world with his followers. He was in ecstasy. And he turned to his followers and he said, did you bring anything with you? And they said, no, we didn't bring anything. You didn't instruct us to bring anything. He said, good. He said, because you'll notice how Krishna is maintaining us. And he said, notice how in the world there's an unlimited supply of food and money. But each living entity can only get what they deserve. Isn't that correct? There's a lot of money hanging around Silicon Valley. But how much can each individual get? All of it? Some of it? None of it? It really depends. We're limited by these factors. So, Narada then says, don't try so hard for that part. It's not that you simply walk away from your responsibilities, but why put your full optimism into that? He said, here's where to put your full optimism. In the prospect that Krishna is offering, that by just a little effort in devotional service, he'll give disproportionate reciprocation. That is, if you just try a little bit in devotional service, then Krishna will come to your rescue right away. He'll give you everything you need to know how to find him. And as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has pointed out in the 11th canto, in one of his commentaries, as much as of an arrangement that God, Krishna, has made for living beings who wish to be an illusion in the material world, and it's quite an elaborate arrangement to allow a living being to live in a sort of trance-like situation, illusory way, he says, if he's made that much a facility for me to be an illusion, imagine how much facility he'll give for one who just wants to be connected to Krishna. It's logical, considering that Krishna is all good and he's the perfect moral agent. He will give unlimited facility for those who apply themselves to devotional service. So this is a helpful calculation to think, why should I invest my complete optimism in the material world? And by doing so, then occasionally be disappointed. Is that possible, to be disappointed by the odds stacked against us? As someone recently was saying, it's all rigged. The whole thing's rigged. Well, it's true of the whole material world. It's all rigged. The whole thing's rigged against us. So don't try so hard for maintaining what is already being provided in a method that is practically beyond our imagination. For instance, even in this body that we have right now, you can actually develop this profound sense of gratitude. Probably you already have this, but this would be a meditation to think, how is it that I've been given this physical body that is the most sophisticated of technologies? Do you think about it like that sometimes? If you ever looked at any of the features of this biological robot that you've been loaned for a few years? Did you know you've been loaned a biological robot that you get to use for a certain amount of time until, and of course, you might want to look at the lease, because the lease says that it can be repossessed at any time. That's something a little dicey. But if you look and see what you've been given, actually, just observe the one of your eyes and watch how it's a perfect lens. All the various features of the eye are so delicately engineered that even Apple hasn't been able to reproduce it in the iPhone 7. Nor will they probably come close, in any recent times. It's a phenomenon beyond what we can imagine, and it's given to us as a facility. So the Vedic scriptures are saying something very simple. When you come out to the point of the Upanishads, for instance, they're pointing out that you have a great opportunity now that you're in the human form of life. And then the question is, how do I take the best advantage of that opportunity? What is the best way to utilize my energy? Like Brian Tracy, the great self-help teacher, often says, ask this question, what's the best use of my time right now? Everyone say that. That's a good question to ask yourself all day long. What's the best use of my time right now? And the answer comes through the scripture that the best use of your time, if you really want to know, because sometimes you don't want to know. You're just like, I don't want to know that. But if you really want to know, and that's a sign of awareness, of higher awareness, that I have an opportunity. In fact, there should be a little a bit of exhilaration, maybe even sort of a little bit of, you know how when you're, if you're rocking in a chair sometimes, have you ever had this happen? Tell me if you ever had this happen. Say you're leaning back in your chair talking to somebody, four-legged chair. You ever done that? You lean back, you're just talking, walking away, and you like lean back a little too far. You don't go all the way back, but you catch yourself just before you do. And you know that feeling you get, right? Before, like, you catch yourself and you come back and you go, all right, I'll be good from now on. I'm going to be serious about life from now on. I'm not going to mess around anymore. Of course, that wears off. But those who are spiritually advanced, they have a little bit of that in them. Because they realize, and this is, comes out in the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj, he says, when he meets Nisringadev, that I'm a little freaked out by this material existence. Everyone else was freaked out by Nisringadev. They saw him and they said, who is it? Even Lakshmi Devi said, don't recognize him. Don't know if it's my husband or at all. Because when God gets mad, he freaks out. And the whole universe was in dismay and taken aback. But Prahlad Maharaj came forward and he said, that doesn't scare me. What scares me is Vishnu Maya. He was looking and seeing how anyone can get caught in the gears. You know, when you work in the kitchen, big machinery and things like that, be careful. You get your sleeve caught and it'll pull you right in, grind your hand, break your arm. And he was seeing the whole material machinery that Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita, Prakriti Kriyamana Ani Gunai Karmani Sarvasya. It's a big machine. And he said, I'm afraid of getting caught in that again, in your Vishnu Maya, and then getting ground up, and I don't know where I'll end up. Little bit of this trepidation of being afraid of the material world and seeing that I've been given an opportunity, I don't want to waste it. Taking that impetus and using it to do what is most beneficial for me right now. So what does the Srimad Bhagavatam or the Bhagavatam say is the best use of my time right now? First of all, Bhagavatam says something, and I'll just give this for emphasis, kamasanendriya prithir labo jivete yavata jivasya tatva jignasya narto yascheha karma bi. It means you got to live. No one's expecting that you just give up your livelihood or give up your immediate source of maintenance. But says, don't do that. Don't take that in order to have kama or enhance sense gratification. There's problems with that. Because one is that you become addicted to it and you won't be able to keep it. So he says, jivasya tattva jignasya, maintain yourself so that you can develop this acute intelligence for inquiry into the higher topics of life, which happen to be, who am I? That's a good question to ask. How many people ask that question, approximately? Well, according to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, not very many. He says, manushyanam sahasreshu kashyad yatiti siddhaye, yatatamapi siddhanam kashyam mamveti tattva. Out of millions of people, hardly one even inquires about spiritual life. In fact, if you do a survey this next week, take a week off, go downtown San Francisco or Mountain View with a little clipboard, and just do a survey, you'll be astounded. And start asking people, what's the goal of life? What will people say? Money? What? Don't know? Be nice to others, enjoy. There may be there could be a variety of that, but you might catch people off guard. That's one thing for sure. There's not a lot of people thinking about it. So Srimad Bhagavatam says, think about it. Kama sanindriya pritir. Life's not meant just to try to enjoy, because you're only going to get a certain amount of enjoyment and you're going to get a certain amount of misery. You're not going to get more misery than you deserve anyway. And you're not going to get any more material happiness than you deserve anyway. And you're not going to change things by working much harder to get more or to get less misery. So it says, Kamasya Nindriya Priti Labu Jive Te Yavata Jivasya Tattva Jignasya. Live to inquire. Organize your energies so that you can inquire and ask the question, who am I? And who's the source of everything? Where does everything come from? And how can I reconnect? If you ask those three questions, then the answers are forthcoming. And this is what I mentioned earlier. Krishna's there within the heart. He's providing intelligence. And he's leaning forward, waiting to see when the living entity is going to ask that question. How do I know that? It's in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. It's mentioned when Gopakumar, who's the hero of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, an epic literature written by Sanatana Goswami about one devotee's progress back to Godhead. When Gopakumar finally comes to Vaikuntha, which is not his final destination, he went back to Goloka Vrindavan ultimately, Lord Narayan met him there and said, what took you so long? I've been waiting for you. Every lifetime I was waiting to see, when will you turn your attention towards me? And you are distracted by what? Name five distractions. Okay, you only get one each. He gave Facebook, WhatsApp, what else? Sleep, money, family attachment. All right, that's five. We could go on for a long time. The whole material world is adorned with these kind of distractions. And he was, Lord Narayan, saying that, I was wondering when you're going to turn your attention towards me. Finally had to intervene. And also, Gajendra. Everyone know Gajendra? What kind of animal is he? He's an elephant. But Gajendra was glorified by Prahlad Maharaj. Because Prahlad Maharaj was wondering, when he was pushed forward to offer prayers to Lord Nrsingadev, what am I going to say? I'm a kid. I'm 5 years old. Not only that, my father's a demon. I come from a bad situation. All the demigods, they've offered streams of excellent prayers in perfect Sanskrit. What am I going to say? And then Prahlad Maharaj remembered Gajendra, the elephant. He said, Bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gajayutapaya. That Gajendra, although he was an elephant, he had a little bhakti in his heart. And when he got in grave danger, what happened to him? It was a perfectly fine day until he went swimming with his family. I mean, everything was going right for him. He was the king of the elephants. He had all the money in the world. He had all the respect of all the animals in the jungle. In fact, when he walked through, people would take off. I mean, what a feeling is that? You walk through and everyone else takes off. It's like, hey. That's how good he felt. He got into that lake and he was helping to bathe his family, thinking, I'm taking care of business here. I'm taking care of my family. Everything's good. I'm on top. And then this crocodile grabbed onto his leg. I mean, has that ever happened to you? In any way? It comes unexpected. We were on Harinam, this was a few months ago. I went into that Pizza Your Heart, pizza restaurant, to just use the restroom, and I was waiting, and I stepped into the restroom, and all of a sudden I felt this burning sensation on my arm, and I thought, where'd that come from all of a sudden? And I took off my shirt, and I looked, and there was a bee sitting in there. I go, well, you know, you weren't watching out, so I bit you. So there you go. And I was thinking, wow, that happened all of a sudden. And that's what happens. Even Radhe Shyam, the great learned pundit who lives in Pune, you know Radhe Shyam? Everyone should know Radhe Shyam. He's a great devotee. He lives in Pune. Right after Mr. Modi, who happens to be the prime minister, if I'm not incorrect, of India. Is that right? He demonetized. He said, one night he got on a, I don't know, was it a Twitter thing like we do here? And he said, these 500s and thousands are no good anymore. And everyone woke up and said, what? When Radhe Shyam wrote an article, said, see, this is how change happens all of a sudden. You may think everything's good. I got a mattress full of those thousands. We're good. No, I don't. I'm just saying someone. And then the next morning you wake up and there's a little tweet It goes out, and it says, thousands are no good anymore. That's how fast it happens. And that's what happened to Gendrendra. He was sitting there thinking, everything's good, and a crocodile grabbed onto his leg. And he said, now what do I do? And he thought for a while that with my strength, I can fight this off. And that's what I think, too. I'm optimistic. If I just have enough money, if I just have enough strength, if I just take the right supplements, that's another thing, multi-billion dollar industry. If I take the right supplements, I'll be fine. It's flimsy. It won't last. It'll all fall through. There'll be a point at which something will come along and it will grab me and pull me out of my current reality. And that's what happened to Gajendra. But because Gajendra had practiced a little bit of devotional service in a previous life, it all came back to him when he was in utter despair. Ever been there? Utter despair? Utter helplessness? In fact, in her prayers, Queen Kunti said, it's a good place to be for devotees. She says, Janmaishvari Shruti Shibir Edamana Madapuman Naivarhat Yavidatum Vai Twamakinshana Gocharam. She said, if you, like Gajendra thought, feel like you're on top of the world or you're a step ahead, you've got it figured out. If you think because you were born in the right place, because you have the right education from the right place, you have enough money, any of these things, it's a kind of drug that goes in your veins and it makes you incapable of actually calling out sincerely to the Supreme. And when all that drains out of your system and you have nothing left, and what makes it drain out of your system? A crocodile on your leg. In whatever form it comes to you in your life, a crocodile will come and grab on. And when that comes out, then she says, if you call out with the feeling that I have nothing and nowhere else to turn, that's when your prayer actually has an effect. That's when your prayer actually has an effect. So Prahlad Maharaj remembered this. He said, Bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gajayuta paya. He said, I'm the most disqualified person here, but they pushed me forward. What should I do? He remembered, if you just have bhakti, if you're sincere, he says in the next prayer, and you just try, then Krishna will accept it, no matter where you're from. And then he even says, even if you're from the lowest family in the world, and the lowest kind of person in the world, doesn't matter what you've done before, if you develop that sincerity and call out to Krishna, he'll be right there for you. And that's what the Vedas are saying throughout, that you have an opportunity now to sincerely inquire. And inquiry also means praying. And the best kind of prayer, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, includes these sacred names of God. This Hare Krishna mantra, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare, means, O my Lord, O energy of the Lord, please engage me in your service. It means, I don't want any other kind of service. I don't want to be engaged in the kind of service, the obligatory service of the material world, that the more I get, the more entangled I get, the more debt I'm in. I want to be engaged in your service exclusively. And so taking to devotional service is a simple thing. It comes from the heart. It comes from a feeling of helplessness. And it's bolstered by good intelligence. Tachchadadhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya paschantyatmani chatmanam bhaktya shuta grihitaya. Suta Goswami says, and what a setting this is at the Naimasaranya, that the Naimasaranya means the place where nobody blinks. That's what the word means, Naimasaranya forest, the forest of no blinking, because everyone's sitting up going, okay, tell us what it is. And there, he's giving these instructions to the sages at Naimasaranya who have changed their minds. They came there because they wanted to perform some Vedic sacrifices in order to get material improvement. And it wasn't working out very well. Their fire sacrifice kept going out and smoke was coming. And when Sutta Goswami came, they put him on a seat of esteem. They said, you're learned. You have been submissive to your gurus. You've dedicated your whole life to spiritual knowledge. And you're a gentle person. Therefore, please instruct us. What should we do? And that's when he started speaking what he had heard from Shukadeva Goswami when Shukadeva spoke the Bhagavatam. It's passed down to these sages in Naimasaranya. And there he says, Tachchadadhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya, that this sincerity of purpose becomes also bolstered, fortified by knowledge and detachment. Knowledge and detachment. This comes naturally by performing bhakti and by hearing Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam regularly. Because you hear in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam something you won't hear anywhere else. You'll hear news about what's beyond the normal course of activities in the material world. No status quo. And Krishna and the sages in the Bhagavatam do not hold back anything. They tell very directly what our situation is. And that's something that you will only hear from them. So if you have that inside track of hearing from Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and then you sincerely pray by especially chanting this Maha Mantra, because it's recommended by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's an authorized mantra given the Kali Santarana Upanishad that says, by chanting this one mantra, you'll overcome all the anomalies of the present age of Kali Yuga. Then you can have immediate traction in spiritual life. And if you maintain at home a regular practice of repeating the verses in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, for instance, if, for instance, you just do one chapter a day, that's a lot, isn't it? To do one chapter a day? It depends. The answer is it depends. Because you get 24 hours in a day, you get to decide what to use it for, right? So it's not a matter of time, it's more of taste. But if you develop a taste for reading at least one chapter of Bhagavad Gita every day, you'll notice for yourself that you're getting spiritual intelligence. And you'll also, because of that spiritual intelligence, have a perspective that allows you to withhold forces or withstand the forces, for instance, of anger or of cravings for the material world. And in the Gita, Krishna says, that's a good thing. Fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, a person who has developed the strength to not give in to anger or material desire becomes a Sukhinara. Everyone say Sukhinara.
Sukhinara.
It's Japanese. Sukhinara. It's not Japanese, it's Sanskrit. But it means it means a happy human. Becomes a habit. Shaknoti haivya shodhum praksharira vimokshanat kama krodod bhavam vegam sa suki sa sa yukta sa suki naraha. You become a suki nara. So this is a very special movement which is giving Bhagavad Gita directly. That's why Prabhupada called Bhagavad Gita as it is. It talks about these various principles that there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not figurative. It's not metaphor. There is a Supreme Personality of Godhead. And all the scriptures line up. They say the same thing. The Upanishads say it, the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas. And it's put together in a framework so that one can understand that. That's important because there are many philosophies in the world. For instance, materialism says, as Satyadev Prabhu likes to put it, there's no boss. No. Materialism says, I'm the boss. And then there's some philosophies, like nihilism, where they say, there is no boss at all. There's no boss anywhere. And bhakti, we say, in my Vod philosophy, there's the idea that you become the boss. But in Bhakti, we say, Jeev Krishna Das E Vishwas Korleto Urdukunai. Krishna's the boss. Everyone say. That's simple enough. That's really simple, and some people think, that's too simple, that's backward, that's archaic. Whatever you like to say, if you're a helpless living entity and you realize you're a helpless living entity and you realize that there is a supreme being who's controlling the universe and you call out and you say, that's not archaic. It's necessity. It's natural. And that's why Bhagavad Gita, as it is, so beautiful. It comes forward and says, there is a God. He's Krishna. And if you think of him, if you surrender and become his devotee, these are the simple things Krishna says. Man mana bhava mad bhakto, mad yaji mam namaskru. What does that mean? Think of me. Can you do that? Can that be done? Say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you can think of Krishna, especially if you know what he looks like. And if you don't know, that makes it a little more difficult, right? Man mana bhava mad bhakto, and become my devotee. How do you do that? Don't answer that yet. How do you become a devotee of a Bollywood star? What would you do? Watch the movies, all the movies. I'm your biggest fan. I go to all your movies. What else do you do? Write him a letter? Follow on social media? Does he or she have a Facebook? Do they have a Twitter feed? Do you get on it? Yeah, what else do you do? Instagram. You got the Instagram. What else? T-shirt, get yourself a T-shirt that says, huh? What?
Read their biography.
Yeah, and then try to go to their place, go to their house. You know, people do that. I know in Hollywood they have buses that go up. How'd you like? They go around and say, yeah, that's where such and such lives. Everyone's like, whoa, look, that's his lawn. That's the grass that he walks on and things like that. That's how to become a devotee. Everybody already knows how to do that. It's natural. Everyone's doing it already. But Krishna just says, switch it over. The Bollywood star is, something's wrong there somewhere. Elvis comes from Graceland. You know who Elvis is. Elvis Presley. People go to Graceland. That's his house. And they worship there. And there's something wrong. Elvis had... Anyway, I'm not going to blaspheme Elvis. But things go sideways here in the material world. They don't when you worship Krishna. So it's a simple, natural thing. Manmana bhavamad bhakto, become my devotee. Everyone knows how to do it. Feel free to do all those things for Krishna. Get on his Twitter account. Listen to whatever he says. Wear the shirt. Get a picture of him. Put it up in your house. Walk around. And people say, what do you do? I'm a devotee of Krishna. That's easy. That's simple. And that's okay. It's better than okay. It's highly recommended. Just do that. Manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji. Then worship. What does worship mean? Actually, the word worship comes from the word worth originally. And when you put ship on the end of a word, it becomes a noun. So worth-ship is what the word used to be. What you think is most valuable in life, put your energy into that. So if one understands Bhagavad Gita and sees how Krishna is the source of everything, matak paratanam nanyat kinchirasti dananjaya mai sarvam idam protam sutri manigana iva. Krishna says in the Gita, I'm holding everything together. I know everything. I'm the source of everything. Then you can offer your, the highest worth, the highest value in life comes from giving my attention, giving my love to Krishna. So offer your worship to Krishna. It's okay, right? You say, no. Vaish, it's better than okay. It's way better than okay. It's highly recommended. Madhyaji mam namaskuru. Now here comes a good one. Bow down. Bow down to me. Has any boss ever told you that? You sure? Subtly they say. You bow down to me. You do. You come into work whenever I say. And if you go home after hours and I call you at 11, you pick up, right? That's the same thing. Just by the way. So, namaskaru. It's the same thing. And Krishna says, bow down to me. So, Does that sound outrageous? If you go to people on the street and you say, you know, oh, we're advocating just bow down to Krishna. It's like, I'm not bowing down. I don't bow down to anybody. But it feels good if you bow down. If you actually bow down, you put your head on the ground in front of the right person. You put it down in front of Krishna. Then you feel like, okay, I'm happy now. That's how you become happy. Simple things. Bhakti is so simple. In Vrindavan, Krishna's hometown, people bow down all the time. All day long they bow down. In fact, it's become a fad, a trend. You go to Vrindavan, you go to Govardhan Hill. And there in Govardhan Hill, people, they offer this Dandavat Parikram. It means you go around the whole hill by offering obeisances. So what you do, you stand there, and then you fall flat on the ground. You with me so far? You put a little marker on the where your hand extends to. Then you get back up, you stand where the marker is, and then you fall back down again. Namaskaru. Now, people go all the way around the whole hill like that. Good idea for a vacation? I'll tell you one thing, it's much better than Legoland, it's better than Disneyland, it's better than Universal Studio, way better than Chuck E. Cheese. But I'll tell you, all those places will drive you crazy. You go there, the kids, and the next thing you know, they are in anxiety, they're all hopped up on the mode of passion. But I see families all the time at Govardhan Hill, all the time. They come from all over India. They bring the kids. They bring their grandparents. I mean, they could barely walk, and there they're falling down on the ground, namaskaru, namaskaru. They're going around. And I go by them, I say, Hari Bo, Hari Krishna, and they're like, Rade, Rade. I never seen anybody unhappy doing that. Whereas I see people all the time coming back from Disneyland completely bummed out and broke, too. Go see the mouse. You're going to see the mouse. Pilgrimage to see a mouse. They made it up. Even George Lucas now is making a $1 billion recreation area to celebrate the characters of Star Wars. This is worship, namaskaru. They'll go bow down to these things and hold them dear in their heart. All Krishna's saying, do that thing for something reasonable. For something reasonable. Find out what's reasonable. And then apply the same kind of feeling that you have and the same kind of activities that you're already doing, but do it for Krishna. Namaskaru. Then he says, just by these simple things, you can come back to Godhead. What else is simple about bhakti? Patram, pushpam, palam toyam, yomi bhaktya priyashchati, taraham bhakti paritam, ashnami pariyatatmanaha. Go find outdoors, you don't have to pay for it, a leaf, a flower, a fruit or water. It's free stuff. It means it grows everywhere. And if you just bring it in for Krishna, then Krishna says, then I'll accept it. It means love. It means there's a reciprocation. And that's how simple bhakti is. So what Srila Prabhupada brought for the world is very practical. It's not a matter of converting from one religious philosophy to another. It's a matter of purifying the heart and coming to the perfectional stage of life, which means to love God. And there's simple ways to do that. The simplest of all ways is to repeat God's names. Every religion of the world holds the name of God to be sacred. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made this the centerpiece of the practice of devotional service. In fact, it's given in the Vedic scriptures that in this Kali Yuga age, there's no other effective means besides this chanting of the holy name. And then there's the Bhagavad Gita. And when it's taken as it is, very directly, it's such a potent medicine that it immediately cures all kinds of indiscretion, all kinds of indecision. It gives one supreme intelligence just by reading the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. Again and again, you read it a little bit every day, and your mind will be fortified, and you'll stay out of trouble, completely out of trouble. Everyone else has to get into trouble. Because they can't help themselves. Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita. They're compelled, they're pushed by the modes of nature to get into trouble in the modes of material nature. It's like, how did you get in such a mess? So the way to get out of it is this simple process of bhakti, especially chanting Hare Krishna and reading Bhagavad Gita. And for those who want the advanced course, they start to get hungry, they want more information, they want to flesh out the entire picture of the spiritual world, Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita are there. And if one uses this very brief flash of human life, so quick, it goes by in an instant practically, to cultivate these very basic principles of bhakti, which are authorized and recommended by the great acharyas, Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Shankaracharya, Vishnu Swami, Sridhar Swami, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and our present acharya of the ISKCON Society is Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who came as a representative of all these acharyas to say the same thing everyone else has been saying, all of the other ones have been saying, and it's available to everybody in Silicon Valley. What could be better than that? Om Tat Sat. And now we'll take a few reflections. Anything that you heard so far that's stuck in your mind that you would care to reflect back so we can augment the point. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for another wonderful class. One thing which stuck in my mind is when you said Kunti's prayers, where the crocodile has to take the drugs from your body away, that you become helpless and call out, chant, and that is a pure prayer that you offer. So if you have to really call it from your heart, you should be in a helpless state. So that's stuck in my mind.
Yeah. The inner prayer, she says, Akinchana. Akinchana Gochara, Janmaishvari Shruta Shribir Edamana Mada Puman, Naivarhat Yavidatum Vai, Twam Akinchana Gocharam. Akinchana, so Kinchana means something. And Akinchana means not something. Nothing. I don't have anything. I don't have any qualification. I don't have anything backing me up. So I feel helpless and I call out. She says, in that state, you can actually chant with real feeling, and that's what attracts Krishna. Thank you. Shraddha.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much for such an engaging class. There are two points that stuck out for me. One was a very balancing statement that you said in the beginning, where you mentioned that do not walk away from your responsibility, but do not put all your full optimism in what you're doing. So that's a very nice thing there. And the second one was the Brian Tracy question that asked the question all the time, that is this where you want to invest your time? And I was just thinking that we could extrapolate that to, especially to the chanting time when the mind goes here and there, and we can come back and ask the question that is that what you want to do? You've stopped doing everything and you're sitting here and still you're thinking of something else. This is the right use of time. So that was really good as well.
Thank you very much. Very helpful. Yes.
Hey, Kishapu. I found, I really would like to go back to that point that you made about Gajendra, when he thought that he was the king of the elephants and he had everything right. And that reminded me of something when Yudhishthira was asked by, at the river, when he was asked by that, I think it was a duck, that had asked him, what do you find when all his brothers had, you know, passed away because they weren't able to answer his questions? He was asked, what do you find so amazing about this, you know, human existence, about this material world? And he said that even when someone is next to a dead body and he may be carrying that palanquin, he still thinks that, oh, nothing will happen to me and I will still be, you know, everything will be perfect. And so it goes to prove that nothing is permanent. And we should be careful where we invest our energy and whether it's impermanent or it's going to last.
Thank you for reminding us. Good point. Yes, Bali Prabhu.
Also, it was wonderful that how you correlate the mapping of the four principles that Manmana Bhava Madhbhakta Madhyaji Mahavanamuskuru in terms of the way the materialistic consider all their object of worship or object of their hero to transform into the Krishna, that is fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a natural phenomena.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I really like the point when you mentioned that bhakti is simple. It's like it's natural, you know, if we just put a little bit of effort, we'll be able to make so much progress. So that was.
Yeah, we were just reading on the way down here the story of Kaliya and how Krishna had gone one day to play down by the Jamuna. And you know the Jamuna River, beautiful celestial river, and there's a lake within that river, and now called Kaliya Ghat. So when Krishna went there with all his friends, it appeared that there was some kind of poison coming from the Kaliya Lake, because Kaliya was this huge serpent that was emitting poison, and even the droplets of water that were coming off of the Jamuna were poisoning, all the plants were dying within 8 mile radius of the Jamuna. And when Krishna came down there, he saw what was going on, and he also saw that his friends and the cows had gone down there to drink from the water, and they had died. And he jumped into the water, got up on a kadamba tree, and described how he tightened his belt, and then he tied his hair. And then he jumped in the water. And even though he was just a little boy, when he jumped in the water, it was like a huge tidal wave had hit that Jamuna Lake. And then he began playing around in the water with his hands, smacking the water. It was making a musical sound that was annoying Kaliya, because it was his lake. And he was swimming, Krishna was swimming back and forth just to annoy him. So when Kaliya saw that, he came out and he bit Krishna on the chest and took him into his coils. And when these things were happening, there were bad omens all over Vrindavan. There were earthquakes, and there was bolts of lightning coming from the blue sky, and people were feeling twitching on the left side, which is an inauspicious sign. And that day just happened to be a day when they kept Balaram back. He usually goes with Krishna to protect him because he's his older brother. But on that day, Balaram wasn't there. And when everyone saw the omens, they thought Krishna must have been killed. So they all ran down to the Jamuna to find Krishna where he was. And when they saw him, this little boy held within the coils of this monstrous snake in this poison lake, they were dying out of fear for Krishna. They had so much love for him. So after some time, and of course Balaram knew exactly what was happening, he was holding everyone back from going into the lake. Krishna, as explained by the acharyas, like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, was simply trying to bring out as much of this feeling that the devotees had there in Vrindavan, so much love they had from it, this augmented it. And then he expanded himself so that Kaliya couldn't hold him in his grip anymore. And he began dancing on the hoods of Kaliya. Kaliya had many hoods, he was a many-hooded snake. And he had many jewels on his hoods. So when Krishna's small lotus feet touched each one of his hoods, the jewels on the heads of Kaliya illuminated Krishna's feet, so they appeared reddish. And it was an uneven surface, because the snake is moving like this. And Krishna was showing off his dancing. Actually, the inside is that he was showing off for the gopis. That, look how I can dance. Many things at once. And after knocking down the hoods of Kaliya, each one would come up to try to bite him, and poison was coming out of him. After some time, he was so beaten down, was Kaliya, that now blood was coming out instead of poison. And then he started to realize his weakness. And he thought, this is the most powerful person I've ever come in contact with. And then realization started coming into his heart that he was actually hosting the Supreme Personality of God. He was dancing on his hoods. And then he gave up. And his countenance changed. And he began to feel humble. And he began to think that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Maybe I should surrender. Now, meanwhile, his wives, the wives of Kaliya, the Nagapatnis, were standing nearby, and they were great devotees of Krishna always. But their husband wasn't. And they were always thinking, like, he's such a rascal. And when Krishna was dancing on his hoods, beating them down, they were thinking, he kind of deserves this. And if he doesn't surrender and he dies because of this, we don't mind being widows. We'll be widows, but we'll just worship Krishna all the time. But as soon as they saw his countenance change and that he became a little humble, they immediately ran in and they began offering prayers to Krishna to save their husband. And there, the Acharya Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur mentions that the reason that Kaliya had become humble was because within his heart he had a little seed of bhakti that he had gotten from his wives. Because his wives were such good devotees. And because he had their association, when he was in the worst possible situation of his life, apparently, that bhakti grew within his heart. So even if we have poison coming out of us somehow, even if our veins are full of envy and so forth, if somehow or other we can get the blessings of the devotees, then when we're in the worst situation possible, we'll be able to call on that seed of bhakti that we get from the devotees. What else? Yes.
My voice is...
Yeah, go ahead. Who's got it? Go ahead.
Okay, I was thinking about the point, Jibosha Tattati Jigasha. Oh my God, my voice is so bad. We should live to inquire. So when we live among the devotees, it's kind of natural that we all inquire. But when we go outside, it's so surprising, actually. People don't even think why they're living. Just day before yesterday, I was talking with my friends who are supposed to be one of the smartest people in Silicon Valley. So when I was asking the question, like, I don't find what's the point of doing all this, or something like that. So they were like, this is the beginning of the quarter, that's why you are asking all these stupid questions. So they think that inquiring about the purpose of life is stupid.
That's true, yeah. And you'll notice this very acutely when you have a lot of association from devotees and then you go outside. We see sometimes, have this experience, at least in Los Angeles, I go down to help Nirukula cook the feast for the Rath Yatra. And I remember one year I was there absorbed for 4 days, just in the kitchen cooking at the Artiques at the temple. In Los Angeles, you never have to leave the block to go anywhere. You're there with devotees. And then we went to the Rath Yatra, and you're still in the bubble. And then as soon as walking off the property where the Rath Yatra is going on, I was shocked. I thought, people are still doing this out here. They're still going on with this. And that illusory energy is so strong. In the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami says that Krishna's illusory potency is so strong that even the most highly educated people can fall into the deepest illusion. So it's not a surprising thing. And therefore, Krishna says in the Gita, "Daivihi esha guna mayi mama maya duratyaya." This divine energy of mine, maya, cannot be overcome by ordinary effort. It takes super human effort. It comes from a higher level. Therefore, we keep association with devotees. It was one of the things that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when asked, what is the symptom of a devotee, of a bhakta? He said, asat sangha. Asatsangachar e Vaishnav achar. He said that the symptom of a devotee is that he avoids asatsanga. Those who are joined in mass consensual trance, to use a phrase of Devamrita Swami. Asatsanga. Yes.
Thank you, Prabhuji, for this nice, enlightening lecture. I remember the point which you mentioned that we have a biological machine, but sometimes we are so caught up that if somebody says you have a beautiful eyes, we are we are caught up on the beautiful word, which is the adjective, and but not on the object, which is actually the eyes that we have. So,
yeah. And just since you mentioned that, when we talk about, we can forget that this is a biological machine and it's not me, right? Yeah. Go ahead.
So I have a question, actually. So you mentioned about the that every living being has the quota, giving the example of the ants in the mountain view compared to the living being, human being. So where exactly we'll find the particular text which Narad Muni describe about the quota, and how do someone know that what is his quota? Means if somebody is in a very poverty condition and if somebody says, oh, that is your quota, or somebody in a little better condition, if that is your quota, how do someone determine that what is really my quota? Because that's why he should be satisfied with, or whether he should pursue further.
Well, first of all, the verses in the first canto, fifth chapter of the Bhagavatam, Tasyaya Vaheto Prayate Takovido Nalabhyate Yad Brahmatam Uparyada. This verse we can look at if you like. And one can understand what one's quota is, first of all, by orienting oneself towards what is actually necessary for oneself. As the Sri Upanishad says, Isavasam idam sarvam yat kincha jagatyam jagat tena tyak tena bunjita magrita kasiswadhanam. This tena tyak tan, this verse says everything animate or inanimate within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. So tena, tyaktena, bunjita means those things, tena, tyaktena, bunjita, those things are set aside for his particular enjoyment, can understand that's his quota. So you can look at your own situation in your life and see what's been set aside for you as your quota. And you may make great endeavor to try to get a different situation. But you should also understand that even if you get a different level of material accomplishment, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get more happiness because of it. In other words, you can try to rearrange your life in various ways. But as the old saying goes, when you come to Bengal, you bring your fortune with you. Or as people say nowadays, that wherever you go, there you are. You take your current situation with you. So one should live a balanced life of self-preservation. And when you have what you need for a balanced life of self-preservation, you have your quota. Even sociological studies show that by getting more than $130,000 a year, I've heard different amounts, $160,000 a year? Only 60? Are you sure? Okay. For Silicon Valley, it sounds small. I don't know if you can get a tent for that much here, but anyway, there is a certain amount of money over which it doesn't add anything to your life. There are social studies which show that there is a basic standard of living after which fulfilling, you don't really get anything more out of it. There's no actual happiness. Studies of people all over the world and their various standards of material happiness have shown that on the happiness index that even people in very affluent countries are not that happy. Bangladesh came out number one in that study that was done by Newsweek about 10 years ago. They had a happiness index and they went around and they asked people under various conditions how they were feeling about their life. And it just so happens that people who have access to family, They're with their families. They're with neighbors. They're with their friends. They can go out and play. They have time to break bread together and things like that. They're happier. In fact, in America, I heard several years ago on public radio about what is called, in a sociological study, a picnic index. One of the ways they measure how happy people are in North America, how many picnics do you go to every year? Do you have time to do that? Do you actually go to a park and have time to breathe the air and things like that? One may say, okay, I want a bigger quota. I want more things. But then they feel depressed and lost and behind and so forth. So one has to see reasonably, what do I actually need in life? And there have been many movements, even in America, like the frugality movement, in which there was a leader of this movement that said, enough's enough. We're working hard for so many material things, and actually, I don't have any time to actually appreciate them, enjoy them, or do any of the things that actually makes the human spirit happy, so what's the use of it? So they started paring down, getting rid of clutter in their lives and so forth. Joe Dominguez, who wrote that book. His book was called Your Money or Your Life? Which would you rather have? So one has to have a little bit of perspective to understand one's own particular situation and see what is one's quota in life. Krishna, after all, says in the Bhagavad Gita, Yadrichcha Labhasantushto, try to be happy with things that come of their own accord. And then you'll feel satisfied. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for bringing us closer to the majesty and mercy aspects of the Lord so easily, and explaining that, you know, He extends Himself in various ways, and you know, it is so easy for us to approach just with little or whatever we have. It's very easy for us to approach Him with devotion. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Yes. Okay, after you, then we're going to go 1, 2.
Manaj, I think yesterday Harivansh Prabhu was telling there are different comparative studies. So I think after today's lecture, we should have comparative studies about Bollywood actor versus Krishna, whom he should be devotee. I like the point was about the when you started the class about the Socrates example. The BTG magazine, the liberation of a cave dweller. So I was just walking on, I think last Friday, I was walking, generally I like to walk, and then I one person passing by, and then he wanted to give me a lift, and then I said, and we recognized that we met 1 year ago in their apartment, and then he started sharing his thoughts, like how, like in 1 year, like he always wanted to read the literature, but never could get, and if it would have been not that, if he would have knocked his door, he would have never read any literature, though he had always desired. So he was expressing his thankfulness, and he told that I started Bhagavatam and I'm 6th chapter, and there are so much doubts come, but I'm going, and then that all doubts get resolved. So I was saying that how this cave dweller is, that light has to come from outside. It's not, you get just being there.
Nice. Anecdotes help to hear how it's practical. It actually works in people's lives. Thank you very much. Who is next? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. The question I had in my mind for so long regarding why Krishna will ask people to be his devotees or worship him, I think you explained very nicely. So I really thank you. Thank you just very much for that.
Why, what did I say?
You explained about the, in a very simplicity, the shloka about what does it really mean to be a devotee? Why would Krishna say? So yeah. Each one of those, you break it, because typically when we talk about that shloka, sometimes people say, why would Krishna ask us to be his devotee? So now, you know, that with that comparison, it's a natural, you know, answer which will really help us in explaining. So thank you.
Okay,
very much.
Good. Thank you very much. All right.
Hare Krishna.
Yes. Yeah. Please, go ahead.
So I was just reminded of one event in Bhagavatam about, there was just mentioned in one sloka, I think second canto, where Maharaj Khatvanga, after fighting a great battle on behalf of demigods, he didn't ask for any material benediction. He asked, how much time do I have? And demigod said, you have just one moment. And he immediately used that one moment basically to come down to the earthly planet and then, you know, pray for the Supreme. And he achieved liberation very fast because he knew what was the prime duty. And so he wanted to focus only on that.
Yes, good point. And also, that story doesn't mean that we should wait till the last minute also. He was a special case, and intelligent person will use the span of life to be ready for the inevitable, which will come at any time. Kanka?
Two things. On that point, the practicing of our japa every day, chanting and sincerely from our heart, when danger comes, we've all experienced this, like we'll be riding in a Sankirtan van and we'll be asleep and all of a sudden the driver will put the brakes on real hard and everyone in the van, because they've been practicing, will immediately come from a deep sleep, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And it's so wonderful to see how how valuable that is to practice every day. And then the other thing, I was going to bring you back to Graceland. Actually, Elvis Presley was given a Bhagavad Gita by my god sister Sunita at the Kennedy Airport. She approached him, and his bodyguards didn't want him to talk to her, but he said, no, I want to talk to her. And she happened to be Prabhupada's first Indian disciple in America. Her name is Sunita, married to Toshan Krishna. And this was in the early 70s when she distributed a Bhagavad Gita to Elvis Presley. He spoke to her for 1.5 hour, asking her very philosophical questions, and then he gave her $50 for the Bhagavad Gita.
And you know, about 20 years ago, at one of our home programs, someone brought me, they had been at a yard sale, and they found a second canto of Bhagavatam. And they brought me that Bhagavatam. They said, here, this is for you. I found this. It was an older style Bhagavatam. And I opened it up and it had a signature in it. And it was from, it was Sunita's book. I think that she had distributed it to somebody else who had left it somewhere and it had gone from one person to the next. She was on the East Coast mostly. And somehow it had made all the way to California. So that these literatures are like notes in a bottle that can float in the ocean for many years and then come up somewhere else. Thank you for that beautiful story. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I like 2 points. One, that body is a biological robot and we are all leasing it. So
yeah, and you eat biofuel every day. That's what you're eating, biofuel. Has nothing to do with the spiritual soul. The soul doesn't eat. But the body, it runs on this fuel. Yeah.
And the second point I like was, utter despair is a good place for a devotee to be in.
Yes. Take complete shelter of Krishna. And now, on Kanka's advice, we'll just review this process of chanting japa. As my great friend Asit Krishna, who lives in Govardhan Hill, at Govardhan Hill, he's the president of that ashram. There, every morning when we have our Mangalartik, and then we say our morning prayers together, and then just before we're about to start our japa for the morning, our individual prayers, he says to all of the devotees, happy japa. Everyone say happy japa. Yeah, so then we sit down and we chant and we remember this is how to become happy. Hare Krishna, and thank you very much for coming to ISKCON of Silicon Valley, and thank you for joining us online. Please, let's hear it for our online audience.